HPPodCraft.com.
Greetings, ghoul friends. This is Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're here at HP Podcraft, Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
And we're here to talk about comments. And to introduce the show is the barbershop quartet, the Four Foxes of Elorn. Take it away. The Comments Show.
That's nice.
Four voices united perfectly.
Yeah.
To sound like one 46-year-old man. That's what they do. The Four Foxes. Let's dig in.
Yes, Colossus of Yelorn, part one. He Who Gibbers writes, I did it. I absolutely did the one thing I said I would never do. Listen to an episode the day it dropped, especially a multi-part story. I can't wait a week. But after going through the agreeably taxing turn of the screw, you had me hooked with Clark Ashton Smith. Now I have to wait like a sad person who waits. I need my stories.
I think the pronunciation of the name is actually He Who Gibbers.
Well, I live in England now, so...
Oh, that's the English pronunciation?
Yep.
Cole Karen writes, I did not know how much I needed this specific kind of nonsense. It's definitely how I felt when I began really reading Clark Ashton Smith. He's not great at scaring the reader or incorporating contemporary settings into his stories, in my opinion, but he's always playful with weirdness. While reading, I can see CAS grin with pride about the nonsense he cooked up. I can't see any author smiles when I'm reading Lovecraft or Howard, just a lot of frowns and clenched teeth. Yeah, there's a sense of fun to it that I really liked.
Oh, yeah, me too. The 1981 AD&D module, Castle Amber, is all about CAS's Averone stories, including this one represented on the cover. There's even a reading list included. Cool stuff.
Yeah, we didn't really mention that in those episodes. Did we? I don't think we did, or if we did it got cut.
Yeah.
So it was nice that people were writing in to let us know that it was in the D&D. I never played. Did you play Castle Amber?
No, I never played that one. No.
To Sir with Lovecraft writes, I wish someone would write a Clark Ashton Smith, Alistair MacLean mashup, The Guns of Averoigne.
Oh! Pagurus writes, the bit about the young and able men coming out of their graves reminded me of that old hard-boiled detective quip referring to a murder victim being in prime health. You mean, apart from being dead. Lewis Brown writes, one of the fun things about this podcast is realizing where Hellboy creator Mike Mignola was inspired for parts of his own franchise. The alchemically created giant made of dead folk in this story seeming like it might have inspired a very short-lived, a chemically created giant made from human fat from early on in Magnolia series, for example. And Justin says, yes, the Hellboy story, Almost Colossus, was absolutely inspired by this story. Magnolia has said as much.
Is it a mashup of Colossus of Elorn with Almost Famous? Is that what that story is?
Yes.
The Screaming Moist writes, I don't remember if it came up on the earlier CAS episodes, but the Emperor of Dreams documentary about him is worth watching if you're a fan. I'd also like to put in a second vote for March Ashton Smith. Well, we're doing Marches for Draculas this year.
Yes.
That's very important.
March is always for Draculas. Come on.
This is a time for everybody to be returning to some form of normality in the world. And if we don't have Marches for Draculas, what was it all for? That's what I think.
Yeah.
So we're going to be doing that. But we will be circling back to Smith for lots of reasons, not the least of which is that we're going to do this half-baked audio drama of The Colossus of Elorn. I actually don't want to know too much about him, though. I think we have mentioned the Emperor of Dreams documentary. I may have even watched it or watched part of it. But yeah. There's a lot that goes into this brain and it doesn't stay there. So I'm going to watch that again at some point.
Robert Poyton writes, loving it. There was a D&D module based on this. And also Jackie Chan versus monks. And he put a link to a Jackie Chan scene from Armor of God. And I was like, oh, you know, I haven't watched that in a while. So I clicked on this link. I don't always click on links, but I clicked on this link. And I watched that whole scene from beginning to end, and my heart filled with joy.
Of course it did. He's the best, and I like that movie a lot.
Oh, yeah.
There's no Jackie Chans out there right now other than Jackie Chan. He's like the last physical comedian we've had. It's a type of comedy I love so much. And yeah, it's kung fu that he brings into it, but it's really rooted in the Chaplin Buster Keaton stuff, how he uses his environment.
He makes that stuff in with martial arts. There should be somebody picking up that mantle because that cannot die with Jackie Chan. There's got to be somebody else doing cool physical comedy fight scene stuff.
Yeah, I think of him less as a successor to Bruce Lee and more as a successor to Danny Kaye and Buster Keaton and those guys. I was thinking about, I watched a Chaplin short the other day that made me laugh so hard because he was a homeless guy. He was sleeping on the street next to a wooden fence and he was cold. So he took a rag and he put it in a hole in the fence and then he felt more comfortable. Such a stupid joke. But I thought nobody does great visual comedy like that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, slapstick is well alive, but that artful, dancer-like, precise kind of vaudevillian comedy is really missing. Get on it, the next Jackie Chan. Darth Pseudonym writes, the Ten Pupils thing sounds like a variation on the legends of the Romanian Scholomance, where the devil runs a magic school with 10 pupils at a time, and the worst student becomes his slave at the end of their training. Scholomance was probably a mistranslation of Solomonary, a reference to King Solomon's apocryphal ability to bind demons to do his bidding. And I think that's definitely right. I also know we discussed the Scholomance at some point for some story. It was directly referenced in something we covered. It might have even been like a Hawthorne adjacent thing or something. I don't know.
Wow. Yeah.
The funny thing is, a story with pupils of Satan in it isn't too unique for us.
No.
And I don't know if anything is anymore. I was thinking of some kind of value prop to lead with when I did the social media posting for the second episode in Candide. I thought, well, there's that monkey love story in there. I could lead with that. And I thought, well, no, we've covered monkey love is an old topic for this show. That's sure like is. Foundational. So
yeah.
Not too much new under the sun for us.
Tim Hayes writes, new Patreon supporter, longtime listener. Always listen at work. Was not ready to laugh as much as I did. I hope my coworkers don't think I was stoned in public.
There was a guy who sat outside of an office I had at this job, and he listened to some 80s podcast that was really funny. But he'd be on his headphones just laughing all day because he was binging it. And sometimes I'd want to give him some work. He worked for me, but I think he's having the time of his life out there. I'm not going to spoil it. So hopefully we're helping you with that kind of workflow.
Yeah.
Peter Larson writes, I am always annoyed at the poor treatment of necromancers in these stories. People are always going on about devilishness and blasphemy and so on, when necromancers provide many useful services. Did your mother die and not leave the password for the Dropbox where all the family photos are kept? A necromancer could help with that. Did your grandpa leave a confusing note in the family genealogy that's going to take forever to sort out on those online services? A necromancer could get the answers in a single shadow-haunted night. You want to know Ulysses Grant's actual last words? That's right, necromancer. And for all these valuable services, they get chased out of towns under threat of torture and death. I suspect that there was an agenda here. As for the whole desecrating graves business, that's pretty nice coming from an anthropologist. The correct word is salvage. If you don't want your loved ones, or even your barely tolerated loved ones, or even your barely tolerated ones, dug up for completely reasonable experiments, don't just throw them away. It's infuriating. I think that's pretty funny. I might use that for that script if Nathair was like, look, I'm creating a giant humanoid home for myself using reclaimed bodies. It's environmental. It's sustainable.
Yeah, he didn't kill anybody.
No. The comment goes on, plus poor Nathair not only gets saddled with a ridiculous backstory about being the child of a demon and a sorceress, described in the most unflattering of terms, simply because he had some mild physical irregularities. It's pure prejudice. Besides, I hear that Alastor and Danielle, yes, she has a name, were very happy together and had a lovely home life. About the worst thing they did was naming their son Nathair, which is kind of hard to say if you've only seen it written. By high school, he would just sigh and say, call me Nate, okay?
Aww.
Right on. Well, I think Nathair as a character is definitely somebody with some right ideas and some wrong ideas. He's a complicated antagonist, which the best are.
They are. And that gets us into episode 531, The Colossus of Yularen, part 2. Lots of talk about our prophecy coming true. You guys are fun. I just love it. You just feed it right into that.
Everybody's playing ball, you know?
Yeah.
I like it.
It's great. Cole Karin writes, I'll show them. I'll become a giant and carry around all the people who appreciate me in a backpack. Then they'll see.
That's how you do it, man. Jason Thompson writes, okay, you made me love this story. I don't remember adoring it, but even going in knowing the ending, you made it super rad and dramatic. However, I still prefer the Seven Geishas. One great monster and a great story is good and all. But how about, I think it's Geishas.
Is it geisha?
Not geishas like a geisha, but I actually do think it's pronounced. It's Seven Geishas, but I think we got in trouble for saying it that way. In my mind, which we've already established, doesn't hold things in it very well. So maybe I just wanted it to be about Seven Geishas. Seven Pose for Seven Geishas is my favorite movie. Anyway, Jason's comment's funny. He says, one great monster and a great story is good and all, but how about seven great monsters and no story? Which is a really good slam.
He's got a point. Sam Martin writes, Necropunk 1277, spending 2 days having your students create a suitable zombie phallus for your necromantic alter ego.
It happened. I glossed over it, but that was a project.
Stephen Bryden writes, this story reminds me of Attack on Titan. There are some similar images and concepts. Yes, that's a Japanese anime. Well, I think it was started off as a manga that got made into an anime and then got made into a live action movie. About giants, like kind of fleshy zombie giants attacking a town. I haven't seen it. I've seen images from it. It looks quite cool. And when I was reading the story, those images did pop into my mind.
Aaron G. writes, necromancers are the original incels, I guess, hating women who rejected them. I really liked, this necromancer.
Yeah.
I think
not all necromancers.
misogynistic tendencies. Yeah. I really liked this second part of the story more than the first, where we got to the good stuff. It made me think of folklore stories about large, maybe not 100 feet tall, skeletons that were in murky pits and swamps. They were called bloody bones and comprised of dead animals and bad children that they found wandering the woods where they didn't belong. From what I recall, Clive Barker used it as inspiration for his Rawhead Rex story, which had a lot of the villain attacking clergy and women.
You know, there's a Susie and the Banshee song called Rawhead and Bloody Bones, and that was on their album Peep Show about that specific folklore. And actually, that folklore is based on, well, it's moved around quite a bit, but in Yorkshire and Lancashire, where I live, it's kind of an old legend. And it moved down to the south of, not just the south of England, but also the United States south. It got brought over there. So the Rawhead or Bloody Bones, same thing, same guy. Well, some of the legends change and the Rawhead's different than the Bloody Bones, but sometimes it's the same thing. But they call him Rawhead because he's got no flesh on his face. He's been skinned off of its face. So that's why they call him the Rawhead. And then he'll eat, you know, children that do terrible things. And it's pretty ghastly, creepy stuff.
Sounds like a good Susie song.
Yeah, it does. Stacey Cahan writes, I'm so, so glad y'all are returning to the Clark Ashton Smith well, because guys, if you haven't read any of his Martian stories, you are denying yourself joy, because it is weird with a capital W-E-I-R-D. How weird? Inspired some sweet OG D&D monsters from the TSR days weird. It's good stuff, and I look forward to listening to you get to experience it for the first time. Well, that sounds like something I definitely want to check out.
I just thought it would have been funny if you'd have said it was weird with a capital W-E-I, and you stopped mid. Like, why are those three letters capitalized? That doesn't even make sense. No, I'm all over it. If it's weird, I want to get into some outer space this year. I don't want any Johnny Lightyear, might as well be a Western. I want some kind of mind-warping star monster, you know, cosmic lizard that can smell justice.
I love it.
Like a flavor that eats skin and it's in space, something like that. Yeah,
beautiful.
That's what I want. Sweating to the Great Oldies writes, the glee in your voice is an absolute delight and balm in trying times. But when Chris said he had to get himself up high so that he could throw this powder into the face, what I heard was he had to get himself up high so that he could throw this powder. And I really like the version I heard better. I mean, what kind of pie? Where would he get the ingredients? Does he have a pie in his wallet? Was that a thing? Sweet? Savory? What kind of pie? And hear me out here. Is it a cow pie that he's looking for?
Oh, geez.
That'd be more satisfying, wouldn't it? Wow. Man, I got to make this movie. Well, hey, look, I'm just saying, a pie delivery system isn't totally crazy.
No.
If you put that magic dust in a pie tin, honestly, you're more, if you throw that or push it, the physics of it will keep the dust in the pie tin.
Absolutely.
As it goes through the air before it hits its target. Whereas if you try to throw it out of a bag or blow it out of your hand, it might go all over the place and not get into the nostrils. Technically, a pie maneuver would be pretty good.
It's classic. Clowns know how good pies are as projectiles. Obviously, that knowledge had to come from somewhere. Necromancers. Makes perfect sense. Richard Inglis wrote the same thing. He said, I misheard Chris. So when he's talking about using magic dust, I thought he said he had to get himself a pie so that he could throw the powder into the face of Nathair. So maybe I actually did say pie instead of...
Well, technically you did, because you said up high.
Up high.
So depending on where your brain separates the word, you did say up high.
Yeah.
So nobody's wrong. Everybody's right.
Yeah, everybody's right. Chargoth Lord writes as well, wait, did you guys seriously go through a whole episode without mentioning Nathair smothering a group of priests to death by dumping a cart of manure onto them?
Gotta leave something for the reading experience.
Yeah, there's so much good stuff in there. That's like a little treasure to save for the people that actually put in the effort and read the story. So we were saving that for them. But also, the story's so good, I wanted to just basically read the whole thing because everything was worth talking about. But we can't do that. We only had two episodes.
Samuel Bevan writes, there's a short story by Clive Barker in the Books of Blood. I think it's called In the Hills, the Cities, where two villages build giants by strapping themselves together. I think I read that he was challenged to make up a completely original horror story. I felt he did a great job and haven't heard of another story with a similar idea until now. Well, what about Voltron or, you know, any of that stuff?
True, yeah.
It's not that new of an idea to put something big together out of components. Off Clive Barker. Episode 532, The Beast of Averroes. What a silly conclusion to take from that. He Who Gibbers writes, yes! The first time I read a non-HBL story before the episode dropped. During the Colossus of Elorn, I believe Chad said the story really lends itself to D&D, and I have to agree, nearly all of CAS's stories have that perfect fantasy element. In that regard, I believe you left out the most important part of this story. The demon speaks with the shrill singing of fire. The Ring of Ebon will definitely be an artifact in my D&D world, and rest assured it will sound like Gilbert Gottfried with too much helium.
What would that even?
Like Chris Tucker in The Fifth Element. I nabbed that ring from that story because I was looking for something specifically in my Classes of Lord script, and I said, oh, I'll use it, except I'm going to break the demon out and have it do some fighting. And then when you told me, oh, in the rewrite of the story, that's actually what happened, I came to that conclusion on my own. Ashton Smith and I did the same thing with this Ring of Ebon. We're brothers, you know?
Hey, it's the sonnet writing Kate Sherrard. She writes, this was, as usual, superb, but wow, I am impressed with the predatory restraint. But sometimes it's all about the jokes you don't tell. Now do Mother of Toads, you cowards.
I am up for Mother of Toads. That sounds like a good Clark Ashton Smith.
Yeah.
But I do want to say, it's human to be afraid. I'm scared of the story. I'm not going to feel bad about it, Kate. You can call me whatever you want.
Jeppe Mulich writes, great story and great episode. The short story was a riff on the historical case of the Beast of Gavaudan, a wolf or a pack of wolves that roamed the French countryside in the 1760s. It led to a great deal of panic, and stories quickly spread of werewolves, reaching as far as the court of Louis XV, who set both professional hunters and soldiers after the alleged monster. It's an interesting story with some good writing about it, including a great book by J.M. Smith. In any case, the reveal was less of a surprise if you're familiar with this history.
Right, and Sanjay Mathew adds, Brotherhood of the Wolf is a meticulous historical recreation of these events. Yeah, we talked about all of that before.
Yeah, we did.
It bears repeating, but we've definitely covered that on the
show. I think it was during Werewolf Month when we're doing werewolf stories.
Yeah.
It came up.
But it's good, not that everybody's listened to all 500 episodes of this show. So sometimes when we say, we covered that before, it's like, when, where? We might as well repeat it.
The Screaming Moist writes, has anyone mentioned the CAS story, Monsters in the Night, yet? It has both werewolves and robots.
See, this is distracting, because when am I not going to want to do something like that? The problem is, I was reading some studies, actually, that just came out, and the audience of this podcast is the only group of people learning a thing right now. So that's a big responsibility for us. School's not working. This is the only thing that does. So, you know, we got to stick with this literature. I can't be doing werewolves and robots every month. We'll get to it. Monsters in the Night, too. I mean, come on.
Yeah, that's great.
What a
God, monsters. Well, that gets us to comments 33. Check the fit. Allison Albright writes, I think the bit about why it is perhaps better that Lovecraft didn't really write women, and the fact that his protagonist could really be any gender, explains some of the appeal of Lovecraft for me when I read him when I was a younger teenager. Especially back then, it seemed like many stories I read, though certainly not all, included versions of women that I couldn't relate to and who only filled certain roles within the story. Lovecraft's omission of the vapid love interest, the scheming temptress, the nurturing mother, combined with the fact that usually the only reference to the character's gender was in a name, meant that they were easier to read without rolling my eyes.
I could see that. Nathan Green writes, I was wondering if there was a chance you guys would ever look into the game Bloodborne.
You know, people keep asking us about this game, and I think we've talked about it before, but I tried it, couldn't get past the first monster. It was a werewolf. It kept kicking my ass over and over again, and it was not fun. It just was not enjoyable. I love video games, but there has to be a level of difficulty that's fairly low, because I don't get to do it very often. So I don't have the time nor the desire to do a level five times over. Like, it's just, not fun for me. I'm sure that's got really cool story stuff in there, because lots of people keep bringing it up to us. But the playability of the game just killed the thing for me before it ever
Same
really
here.
Started.
Yeah. So look into it. I did that, but I didn't play it very long.
No. Alashiba writes, every single one of Lovecraft's characters would try on that mask, get chloroformed, and wake up in a temple and go mad from witnessing something unspeakable.
I was trying to imagine, would a Lovecraft protagonist fall for a scheme so transparent? The answer's probably yes. I mean, Houdini did go box on top of the pyramid, so. Devin Morris writes, I can't remember the episode or reader, but Chad's quote was, speaking of tenacious, our reader for this episode is Anthony Tedesco. You know, I once saw him catch a pigeon in his mouth. That's how tenacious he is. I remember this and have actually paraphrased it on occasion. Well, that's not, I remember now, although I question my takeaway of tenacious. I think if I saw that just randomly, I might think, man, that guy's hungry. So different days, different takeaways, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. Gavin O'Brien writes, wasn't this comment show, but the last one where you all read my comment about sake. When you read my name, my heart jumped so badly. I never expected you all to actually read my comment or say my name. It was just an overwhelming feeling that swept over me. After listening to you all for 9 or 10 years, I got a feeling of being starstruck.
Well, your heart's going to jump even badlier when you hear your name from the Four Foxes of Ilorn. Gavin! Dino Brain. Listen to those ladies go. I mean, when you hear them, they sound like one doughy 46-year-old man. I don't know how they do it.
They're
harmony
amazing.
Is so precise, it sounds like one kind of crappy voice. But yeah, that's their song. That's their
they
hit.
Do. They do it.
Four Foxes of Elorin with Gavin O'Brien. Episode 533, The Maker of Gargoyles. Jeppe Mullick, we are probably murdering that name. Is it Jep or Jeppe? We'll find out. Writes, you joke about the difference between 1138 and 1289, but this is one of the more hotly contested periods of European history among medievalists. People either refer to it as the crisis of the 12th century or as the 12th century Renaissance. Well, already I could tell this is hotly contested. Those titles are pretty inflammatory. The aftermath of the Norman conquest and the First Crusade saw monumental transformation sweep across Western Europe. This was a time when bureaucracy slowly began creeping into the otherwise autocratic governance of monarchs after the spectacular failures of rulers like King John of England. It was also the age when grand cathedrals and monasteries were built, and I think the Maker of Gargoyles might be riffing on the real-world Basilica of St. Denis finished in 1144. Is this relevant to the Averroes stories? I'm not sure, but historians got a historian. I'm sure I was being unfair. I think I even said it, but we're all narcissists anyway, because to even make the comment I made, you have to sort of think that we're in some period of great change, but you don't know. In the long view, people might go, they were at war with Germany, right? Isn't that all that happened in that century? You know, this could just be the World War period and nobody will know what the difference was in anything. I mean, we act like because we've made this progress with technology, that's somehow shown some, well, progress. But I don't know. We killed more people than ever in the 20th century, so I don't know about that progress.
And in the future, anyway, we're all going to be dog boys, so it won't really matter. Corey M. Wittig writes, allow me to be the first to raise the topic of the Gargoyles cartoon from the 90s, of which the story reminds me for obvious reasons. You guys were probably a little too old for it, but it was really a great show and tied into tons of folklore and, weirdly, lots of Shakespeare. Not quite to Batman the Animated Series level of quality, but very good. The head gargoyle was named Goliath and was voiced by Keith David. Oh, I love Keith David.
I was just going to say that. I love him.
Nothing insightful to add. Yeah, he's great. Every time I hear him on a commercial or anything, and he's a great actor too, obviously.
Yeah, he's awesome. I like Gargoyles. I think I watched it sometimes, but you're right. I was a little old to be sitting there with my after-school snack watching it.
Yeah.
But I thought it was a cool idea.
I saw it here and there, but I never got hooked into it. It's on Disney Plus now, so maybe I'll try and make the kids watch it with me.
I think Gargoyles was right on that cusp of changing from that Funimation kind of silly, you know, nobody really cared about the plots too much, into more adult, let's actually try and make this good. I think the Batman the Animated Series reference is right. That's in the 90s when animation changed over the, you know, there's no reason for this not to also be good storytelling.
Yeah.
And I think Gargoyles was one of those transition shows. Mm-hmm. Steve writes, I also had a look at Anglaise. It's a small place with only slightly more inhabitants than the podcast has patrons. Well, it must be huge then, Steve. The church is a big lump of a building with plain walls on the outside and a few windows. The only ornamentation seems to be the aforesaid Malbet. I murdered that when I was talking about it. Yeah. Although it's not quite as impressive as one might hope.
Oh, man. Did you look at the picture of it?
Yeah, I mean, I saw that stuff before I made the comments about it. Oh, I wasn't going to tell people how sad it was.
Oh, the poor little guy. He's so pathetic. He looks like, not big, it looks like maybe it's a foot long. I don't have any frame of reference because it's just on the roof, but it looks small, but it also looks like he's dry heaving over the edge of the building, like he just drank too much at his first college party. It's not terrifying, it looks sad, like I feel bad for him. He's learning
but,
the hard
you know,
way.
That's because you feel bad because you have empathy because you're beautiful inside and out, and that's exactly when the Malbet strikes.
Oh my God.
Peter Larson writes, I did like how the sculptor wasn't exactly a villain, but really just a jerk with too much sculpting talent. Not enough self-reflection. He seemed honestly horrified at the carnage and did his best to get revenge afterwards. If only he'd spent his sculpting time thinking really hard about well-made omelets or a nice crusty baguette. Could have been a happy story.
He really dropped the ball. Shay Fargo writes, okay, why are we known for our bridges if we have gargoyles? That's not fair. And Shay is talking about Pittsburgh here. Shay is from Pittsburgh, and I went to college in Pittsburgh. I know that town, even though I don't remember seeing any gargoyles. I lived there for over 2 years, 2.5 years, but I felt nostalgic. So I went back online and to see if any of the old comic book shops that I used to go to were still there, and Phantom of the Attic is still there, like 30 years later.
Wow.
Amazing. Episode 33, HP Podcraft predicts.
Right. We don't need to get into too many comments on that, but Dan Pratt wrote, sudden unexplained spike in amazing Criswell album sales, which was the intent of the whole thing. So we're glad you're buying up Criswell's work. That was a fun episode to do, and I'm glad that folks let us do it. As always, with those bonus episodes, it's so nice to be able to talk about, you know, whatever's on our minds.
Yeah.
Although this month, we are going to be in theme with it. We're going to be talking about Candide with Mr. Matt Barisi.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to it.
Matt always has really cool, insightful things to say, and he's a fun guy. I love the dude.
But that's all we have for this comments show. Thanks, folks, for tuning in. We've really enjoyed what you had to say about these stories, and keep writing those comments. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you're listening to HPPodcraft.com.
Strange studies of strange stories. Listen to those foxes go.
Wow, they're great. Comment show.